Hello, everyone. Welcome to Real Blend, a podcast that has just as many Oscars as Johnny Depp.
Ah, for now, Kalina, for now we do. That was Kalina, a dedicated Real Blend listener who actually tried to steal my gig via social media earlier this week, but more on her devious efforts in a moment. First, my name is Sean O'Connell. I'm the managing director here at Cinema Blend, and this, in fact, is episode number 33 of Real Blend. We are a weekly entertainment podcast dedicated to all things cinema, and the show is co-hosted by my fantastic friends and very close colleagues, Jake Hamilton of Fox 32 in Chicago. Hi, Jake.
I am sort of curious as to how Kalina would introduce me. I'm not going to lie. I'm a little, I miss Kalina.
She's a little bit better at this than I am. Well, I wonder what she'd say about Kevin McCarthy, entertainment reporter of Fox 5 in Washington, D.C. Hi, Kevin.
Hey, good afternoon to you, Sean, Jake, yes. And Gabe, our producer. Thank you, as always, for letting me be your friend.
Well, that was Kalina. And earlier on social media, she decided, in a moment of me quitting the show in rage, Jake Hamilton style, she decided she would audition for this seat and decided she would send this to Gabe, her introduction. So if you guys have introductions that you would like to hear on the podcast, obviously you can send them to us and we're not above just cutting your audio and using it for our benefit.
And taking complete and total credit for your work.
So every week we are live here on the Cinema Blend Facebook page. Hopefully some of you are watching us here. Please say hello, drop us a comment or a question. Producer Gabe behind the window will drop it into a chat that we can maybe answer to it. You can also download us after the fact on Google Play, on Spotify, on iTunes, and other such outlets. And there you can leave us a review. And we have 18 reviews so far, which is totally amazing. We love reading them at the top of each new show. So this week's review comes from Jordy Snye, who says, just his subject line is just subscribe already. I've been listening. Yeah, I know, right? Just subscribe. I've been listening since the early awards blend days. And I have to say, this podcast is a breath of fresh air. There's no cynicism. I should practice these beforehand. No air of pretension. All three hosts' enjoyment and appreciation of film is contagious, and that's truly something to celebrate. If that wasn't enough, their experience interviewing directors, writers, and stars brings extra insight that I don't hear on any other show. Finally, the weekly blend game is the cherry on top. Being able to play along on Twitter is one of the highlights of my week. Thank you, Sean, Jake, Kevin, and Gabe for putting out this awesome show every week. Keep up the great work, he says. I think that's
really nice.
That's incredible.
That's cool. Incredible. And he brought up something that I thought was interesting because that I guess I never really thought about the idea that while we do this podcast and while we're movie fans, we are obviously our jobs are connected to the business and we're in the room with the people we're talking about a lot. And we have that ability to have that access and sit down with our heroes. So, yeah, I mean, it definitely I didn't really think about the fact that that brings an extra level of authenticity to what we're doing, which is kind of cool.
So Aaron Burr would say, we're in the room where it happens.
I want to pull back the curtain too, like right before this episode started. These two are name dropping the number of times they've interviewed Robert De Niro. Oh, do you remember that first time we had De Niro? Oh, then we went and got that picture with De Niro. And
no, we named the number of times that Robert De Niro has been interviewed by us.
Yes. I won't say who, but there's an A-lister who was in a photograph with Robert De Niro and Jake who got cropped out. Because at the time, he wasn't A-list enough, apparently. So
he wasn't De Niro A-lister. Hey, that'll we have someone on Facebook watching from South Africa.
Oh, that's awesome. Nice. Hello.
Jake and I have known each other since 2010. And we, people who aren't aware, we used to do these things called geek out dinners. So we would basically...
Used to.
We still do them now. But like they used to be pretty like hardcore. Like, I mean, in the sense that we would get back on a Friday night from like a movie and sit in the room for 3 or 4 hours. I remember our Oprah night, Jake. Remember that?
Yeah.
But the, we would just go over questions, and De Niro was a big one for us. I remember that very vividly because him
we
and I
like,
were
practice our questions on each other.
Yeah. And I remember, like, because I was so nervous because I had my heat ticket, my heat ticket from 95. And I was, and I remember De Niro was paired with Michelle Pfeiffer. And I was like, how do I bring this out to him and make it a bit about that without Michelle Pfeiffer getting like, you know, getting bored by us nerding out about Heat, and he was so cool about it. I remember him, like, signing the ticket and, like...
Yeah, didn't he randomly just start signing it without even asking you? He just, like, took out a pen and just started writing on it?
Well, I just wanted to find out, because there was always that controversy surrounding the fact that maybe De Niro and Pacino didn't shoot the Heat scene together, because there's never a two-shot of the both of them face-wise in that diner scene, which I then got clarified by him and Michael Mann, which is, it's just an epic moment. If you haven't seen Heat, anybody listening to our show, definitely see it. I'm sure you have.
But. We're changing the name of the podcast to a Name Drop Blend. So yeah. Tune in next week for hashtag Name Blend. Name Drop. We were actually saying that the timing of this week's episode is perfect, because right before we got on, a huge bit of news, and this sort of goes back to our awards blend days, Oscar changes. So let's dive right in to this week's episode, where we can discuss a major shift by the Academy to hopefully get more of you guys interested in tuning into the 3-hour Academy telecast. There is going to be a new category, and from everything that I'm seeing, it's going to start like this year. Like, starting with the next Academy Awards telecast, they're going to have I want to make sure that I'm reading this the right way. Achievement in popular film, which the reaction.
What does that mean exactly?
Let's talk about that. Like, how do you define? How are they going to define what is popular? Automatically,
or achievement.
I'm assuming
like,
it's
what,
box
like what sort of achievement? Like, is it a special? Is it like the special effects in Planet of the Apes? Is it the pop culture a shift? That Black Panther calls? What does even, like, the achievement mean?
Well, right off the bat, it's being called the Black Panther Oscar. Like, yes. Literally, a movie that has grossed, you know, a staggering amount of money by itself, that if you stepped back, and Kevin, I know that you have a big opinion on this, if you stepped back and tried to ask, is Black Panther an Oscar contender, I think the Academy's reaction is, no, it's not. And I think that is deeply flawed. I don't think Black Panther is the only movie that's sort of affecting this. I think they're looking at movies like A Quiet Place even too, which was really popular and wouldn't necessarily in years past contend for an Oscar, despite the fact that, like, yes, they have made some concessions for films like Get Out, which crosses genres. But it just feels like a really cheap and lazy category to catch all
also,
to movies that...
Does that imply that popular films will now never be nominated for Best Picture? Like, why can't a popular film, like Titanic, won Best Picture? Like,
And doesn't it automatically, like, backhandedly call the Best Picture nominees unpopular?
Unpopular.
Unpopular, yes, right? Yeah. That's the reaction. So I don't understand this. I don't understand this on any level.
To me, this is one of the most ridiculous, ignorant, and dumb things I've ever heard in my life. And I have a problem with the idea that the Academy, and I've said this a lot on my Twitter feed and when the nominations come out and the winners happen, and I'm sure you guys all agree, there is a quote-unquote type of Oscar film. I mean, we're all guilty of this. We'll watch a trailer and go, that's going to win an Academy Award. Like, you can just tell what an Oscar movie is going to be, and generally it's a drama. Generally, the drama category is kind of where the Oscars find their movies. And I think the biggest problem with the situation they're doing here with the popular film is that all they need to do is just rethink what they consider to be an Oscar movie. That's all you have to do. You need to view there's not equality when it comes to genres at the Oscars. They need to view drama the same way they view comedy and horror and action. And I think the fact that an action movie could never be up for Best Picture or win Best Picture. I mean, I know Star Wars was nominated in 77, that's sci-fi, whatever you want to do, but rarely you get an action film. Now, Black Panther is an interesting thing because I love Black Panther, but I personally don't think it deserves a Best Picture win. If I were to go in the superhero element to bring into this category, I would go more on the Avengers Infinity War side.
I agree.
I just think it's a better film. So I think the Black Panther element of it, as Jake said, it's a cultural shift. It was a big deal. But to say something, to give it a popular award at the Oscars, is basically going against and continuing with this idea that Oscars have to be this certain specified type of movie, like The King's Speech or The Artist or Shakespeare in Love, films that, in my opinion, do not stand the test of time and did not deserve Best Picture. And now we're dealing with this idea that you're making a category to excuse the fact that you're too lazy to actually start considering other genres.
All right, well, let me play devil's advocate. Let me play devil's advocate real fast. By introducing this category, aren't they kind of saying that now we're going to consider some of these movies to be Oscar, Oscar movies? Because they're still going to get an Oscar.
But they're putting them in a category
that Oscar.
Right, exactly. It's winning.
It is gross.
You're winning. Yeah.
Why did they do like a stunt Oscar or a choreography or a voiceover acting Oscar? Like a category that recognizes an actual craft. I do have. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to put on my tinfoil hat for a second. My conspiracy theory hat.
Ooh, this is going to be good.
Okay, Disney just bought 20th Century Fox.
Okay,
which means that they own a massive number of the franchises that put out all of the big blockbusters every year. Disney, correct, which is the same umbrella as ABC. ABC, which airs the Oscars, they are guaranteeing themselves at least one Oscar every year.
Mm. That's fascinating. I mean, the thing about it is, like, Pixar, you're always locked in to win. So that's ABC. That's always happening for them. But that's a great point, though. I mean, like, because by the time the Oscars roll out, Deadpool's now Disney. I mean, all these movies are now Disney.
Marvel, Star Wars, Pixar, I know X-Men's looped into it, but all of the franchises that come with Fox, there's at least like four, like all of the Disney properties will be competing against themselves for that one Oscar. They created a category for themselves.
I just find it so frustrating that we are still in a boat where it's still the typical Oscar film. And I think we can all agree, if we look at years over years of Oscar winners and losers, like one of the worst moments ever in the history of the Academy Awards was the nomination of The Reader over The Dark Knight. Now, we don't know for sure how close The Dark Knight was to being in there versus The Reader, if that's the one that actually knocked it out. But I believe it's actually...
It was because everyone thought it was going to be the other four plus The Dark Knight.
Right. But it is a factual thing that the Academy went to 10 nominees because of The Dark Knight, right?
I don't think they ever admitted it, but it's the most universally accepted theory.
But that, to me, is the perfect example of the Academy's problem. Like, The Dark Knight was clearly a Best Picture nomination that year, if not maybe the winner. I don't remember what won that year. But what did win Best Picture the year The Dark Knight was nominated that Ledger won? Anyways.
Was it Slumdog Millionaire?
Possibly. It was 2010. Actually, you might be right. I might have been in 2009. But
I'm pretty sure it's Slumdog Millionaire.
Okay, Slumdog was great. But yeah. Dark Knight, what did Dark Knight do? I mean, Jake, I always quote you on this. Jake had a great quote. Well, this is actually you quoting Matt Damon, I believe, right? Why don't you go ahead and say it, because you told me.
I've never seen where he said. I always just heard that Matt Damon has said that you should award Best Picture 10 years after the movies have come out. So it gives you time to reflect and look back on the impact that movies have made. That way, you're not awarding Best Picture to a movie that no one's talking about in 5 years, a la The King's Speech.
So here's the interesting thing about that statement. It's never going to happen, obviously. They're not going to do a 10-year delayed Oscars. But if you look at Matt Damon or Jake's point about that aspect, it applies to almost every year. So the year Social Network and Inception were up against The King's Speech. What films from that year out of those three are still being talked about, dissected, and taught? Right, I mean, King's Speech is a fine film. It's a very good movie. But Inception and Social Network were game changers, and I think we all knew that at the time when we saw Inception. We knew how big of a deal that movie was. When we saw Saving Private Ryan, we knew how big of a deal that movie was. But I'm telling you, and we all know this, Oscars come down to campaigning. But now that Weinstein's out of the picture, I think that's going to change a lot, because that guy ran a campaign like crazy. I mean, if you've got Shakespeare in Love to beat Saving Private Ryan, that's full-on politically campaigning.
But
and there's no way.
The introduction of this category is the Academy essentially admitting that the Best Picture win holds no value anymore, which is something that I think we kind of recognized over the years anyway.
But it does hold value,
or is it splitting like Golden Globes, where it's essentially, rather than splitting into drama and musical comedy, is it splitting into independent films and blockbusters?
Well, let me bring
that's actually
the
a great point
three.
Because the because the comedy musical category of the Golden Globes, you're right, Jake, is very similar to what these popular, like The Hangover got nominated in the musical comedy category.
We haven't even started talking about the fact that they're going to start giving away Oscars during commercial breaks.
Which,
like, can you imagine us not getting to see Roger Deakins win his Oscar?
No,
like, who's going to determine like whose major life moment should not be seen? Like, so, like it shouldn't be during a commercial break. It should be on a separate. If you're going to remove some categories, and I believe I'm on record on this podcast having said that you should give it another night. Don't squeeze it into because we've all been to award shows.
Some of them can go away.
We vote for award shows. They give away awards during commercial breaks, and it is incredibly awkward. People are getting up, they're walking around, they're talking, they're going to the bathroom. Someone's trying to give a speech and have the moment of their life while everyone's talking over them. It is a horrible idea.
People have gotten up to the stage and said, oh, I guess we don't warrant the telecast. Yeah. I guess we get the commercial break. And I think it does feel bad.
I think every category that's been in the Academy Awards over the past decades should be telecast live. And here's my opinion on this situation. So the Oscar telecast is normally what, 3.5 hours? That's the normal time frame.
I feel like it's now they're closing on four.
Okay, four. All right. So now they're saying they're going to bring it down to three, which in my opinion is not really a big difference. It's still a long show. Here's the thing: there are so much other things you can cut from that show. I understand the idea that the below the line awards may not be interesting to a lot of people. But then you got to think about the person who's winning that award. I understand that, but then where do you start cutting lines? I mean, like, for example, when Deakins won, if Deakins wins cinematography, right? I mean, that's a really big deal for. I mean, but is it a big deal for the general audiences? I don't know. But I mean, like, does that deserve to be not televised? I mean,
yeah,
like,
no, it's definitely not. And I don't think it's that. I think it's like documentary short.
Yeah,
great for them. Short. Tremendous for them. I don't need to see it. I don't. I feel like, for a show that's so long,
they should not be secluded to a commercial break. They like, why can't they have their ceremony on Saturday night and then and then they all get to go to the ceremony on Sunday with their Oscars?
Absolutely, sure.
Well,
I think that's what they would have to do,
Jay, because they would have to just literally divide it to technical awards. It would have to be everything technical. So then,
I don't disagree. I disagree with that because I think there are some technical awards that you could justify are more recognizable because at least with something like cinematography, there are going to be recognizable movies nominated that people know.
Right.
No one knows what the documentary shorts or the animated shorts are, but at least they know what Blade Runner is.
Let me drop one on you guys. I don't think the most casual viewers care about Best Director.
Then what are they watching the Oscars for?
It's a big deal. The director...
They might not be able to understand it, but I think they recognize that a director means something.
I actually think that's a great idea. So everything we just said... So cinematography, score, visual effects, films that have big names tied to them stay in the telecast.
Even I'd argue, I like sound and sound editing. I don't think people truly appreciate sound and sound editing, but I think, and also sound and sound editing are often given to movies that people know. They're often given to the Dunkirks and the Jurassic Parks and the Mad Maxes.
Yeah. Like when I was watching the Oscars that year and Mad Max was racking up those tech awards, I was getting so excited.
They need to look at what categories nominate films that people know.
Okay, well, let me ask a question. This popular movie category, it's been introduced solely to attract more viewers that don't pay attention to the Oscars anymore because they think they're going to put in movies that the mainstream audience will care more about. Do you think that will work? Because I don't.
No. First of all, it's belittling other. Honestly, it basically
it's a popularity contest.
It's a slap in the face to basically what you're saying is that your film is not quality enough to win a Best Picture Oscar.
Yeah.
But we're gonna give you an award because your movie made a lot of money.
So Ryan Coogler wins this year, right? If Black Panther gets it,
who wins? Who gets the trophy? Coogler? Or the
probably the producers.
I
think it works as a Best Picture. I think it's another category, a Best Picture type category. I think. I don't know.
Is it possible to be nominated for both?
You can be eligible for both.
So if Avengers Infinity War, this is where it gets interesting to me because I think Avengers Infinity War, and I understand that I'm a comic book movie fan, and I get that I may be a movie nerd or I geek out, whatever, but Avengers Infinity War is a genuinely great film from every single.
It is better than Black Panther.
It's way better than
Movie of the Year. It's my number one movie of the year currently, right now.
Here's the thing: Black Panther is a very good movie, and I recognize that what it did, the cultural shift, as Jake said. I think that it's phenomenally directed. I think Michael B. Jordan is phenomenal. I do think there's some CG issues in that movie and some pacing issues, but other than that, going back to Infinity War, Infinity War is honestly a masterclass in pacing, editing, directing, performance, Great. And juggling storylines. And if that film is put into a category like this popular category, it's completely belittling the fact that great filmmaking went into that movie. And that's why I was so frustrated with The Dark Knight not being nominated and films like that, because we haven't yet had the ability for the voters to understand that drama is not the only genre that needs to be awarded. And I think that Mad Max should have won Best Picture. I mean, it's ridiculous what's happening here.
And also, I mean, I keep going back to this. I'm confused as to what the award is actually for. Is it Best Picture for popular movies? Is it a particular achievement within a popular film, like Andy Serkis within Planet of the Apes? Like, could Andy Serkis have gotten it for Planet of the Apes?
Yeah, they haven't defined they haven't defined what that is.
Yeah, is it like a specific thing or the movie in general? Like, if Black Panther is nominated, is it Black Panther as a whole?
If they're smart, they'll keep it vague enough so that every year they can just do something to acknowledge whatever the big daddy popular movie is, right?
And like, Andy Serkis has to be ticked off right now, because in theory, could he have won an Oscar for his achievement in popular film in Planet of the Apes?
Sure. Well, Jake brings up an interesting element about the Andy Serkis thing, because, and you guys, we're all vocal about this. I've been extremely vocal on Twitter about Andy Serkis for many, many years, being nominated for an Oscar just for acting. I don't want Andy Serkis nominated for a special Oscar. I want Andy Serkis nominated for Best Actor.
I don't disagree with you.
I just have a hard time with these special categories and the idea of putting someone in a box where they're not in the grouping of what's considered to be the best. So, for example, I mean, the Andy Serkis thing is so mind-blowingly frustrating to me that the Academy still does not understand that he's just acting.
It's because of the average age of the Academy members. I think unfortunately, a lot of these older Academy members, with all due respect, start dying off. It's going to take a younger Academy to recognize someone like Andy Serkis, unfortunately.
There is zero difference between what Andy Serkis did in Caesar for the Planet of the Apes and what Gary Oldman did in The Darkest Hour. The only difference, and these are Andy's words, is the makeup. So you see physically Andy or Gary on screen with makeup on his body, and then the only thing you're seeing with Andy Serkis is the digital makeup on top of what he performed. So it's so mind-blowing crazy to me, because you can look at Gary Oldman and give him an Oscar, even though you can't see him, he's covered in a ton of makeup, but then you can't understand that Andy's doing the exact same thing, just digitally being added makeup to him. That's all it is.
I still think if we're going to add a category, it should have been stunt work.
Stunt work!
There are decades of stunt work that's gone underappreciated and undervalued. And, I mean, honestly, how cool would it have been for Mission Impossible Fallout to win an Oscar for its stunt work?
Yeah. Now, who wins for that? Would Cruise accept
that? I don't know.
That?
Is that Cruise's first Oscar? To win for stunt work? And would that tick him off? If that was his Oscar.
Well, okay, so we have to move on. We have to move on after this. But literally, you're going to come up with two categories where the winners in them are just going to feel disappointed. Because whoever wins is going to say, well, how come I can't be in that category?
Special effects.
Yeah, and whoever wins Best Picture is going to be like, does this mean we're not popular enough? Like, are we not? Let's say Moonlight, won that year. It won Best Picture, but it wasn't even in the popular category.
Yeah.
Right? You win the... Both of them feel like consolation prizes, and it's really...
Yeah.
I don't see how the Academy didn't
recognize
that. Is there
any chance they... I mean, I feel like I've seen a lot of backlash to this on social media just within the past couple of hours, because they just announced it a few hours ago. Any chance they backlash, or are they sort of like, well, we're in this now?
No, it's like James Gunn. It's like the James Gunn decision. You've made it, and you got to live with it now.
Yeah.
Well, it's very frustrating to me. I think it's ridiculous. I think if you're going to make the show shorter... Then make the show shorter to like 2 hours. I mean, I have no problem watching a 3-hour broadcast of the Oscars, because I'm so into this business and the movie element of it. But I get that no one's going to want to sit there for 3 hours. Cut the show short to 2 hours and get everything. You can get everything in an hour if you really had to. But they're doing it because they want to sell as much advertising as possible, cover as much landscape as possible. But the popular thing is one of the dumbest things I've ever heard in my life. Ever.
Well, one of the only reasons that I'll be happy about the popular category is if they recognize First Man. Kevin, let's talk about First Man, because we went and saw the IMAX footage. We actually went back to Fallout to see this new presentation. Jake was he didn't want to do it. He didn't care. Doesn't care
it
enough.
It comes out in like 4 days. I'm not going to see 5 minutes. I'm annoyed.
About?
It comes out in October. That's the month after next. I'm a little annoyed that Kevin and I in a few weeks are seeing 30 minutes of Bohemian Rhapsody. I don't like seeing a chunk of movie before I
that
see
is
the movie.
Weird.
I just want to see the movie.
It's just a trailer, Jake. It's just a trailer formatted to IMAX. It's not like you're watching a chunk of the film or anything.
Wasn't it the moon landing sequence?
No, tell us
okay, on the podcast.
Hold on. Wait. So First Man is the story of Neil Armstrong and the launch to get to the moon. And the reason why we care is because it's the patron saint of one of the patron saints of Real Blend.
Yeah.
To me, on a Mount Rushmore of current working filmmakers, Damien Chazelle, whose films include Whiplash and La La Land, which both of those should
you
come back around.
You would put him on the Mount Rushmore of current working filmmakers?
I would. Yes, I would. I would put him right up there. I think his films, his last two films have been my number ones the year they came out. So,
if we could do this in 2 minutes, can you guys give your quick four?
Spielberg, Tarantino, Scorsese.
We will go so far down.
Tarantino, like, Spielberg, Nolan, Scorsese, Abrams. I mean, Chazelle's definitely up there, but I wouldn't say he's one of the...
Sorry,
Gabe had a heart attack.
I know.
Okay, tell us about the First Man footage.
Bookmark that. Oh, so it's... And here's why I think this is going to be really exciting. What it chose to focus on was the human element of the borderline impossible quest to get from the Earth to the Moon. And it's something that I just don't think we focus... What's going to separate this movie from other films about the space race is that... And Jake, you brought this up in an earlier podcast where it's like the lights shaking showed that like these guys in Texas and Florida who are working for NASA were just regular people who were really working with the tools that they had at their disposal. And
we're using
joke...
more technology right now than they had to get to the moon. And that is terrifying.
Crazy.
That is terrifying.
So
the fact that they couldn't even get the lights to be stable. Like, imagine the last thing you see before getting into the rocket is the fact that they couldn't even stabilize these lights before getting it. That is terrifying to me.
And the joke that it plays better in this footage is the Swiss Army knife joke, where like someone says, like, does anyone have a Swiss Army knife? And because what they had to do was there was like a little latch, plastic latch that they had to like free up, and they just needed like a little thin thing to get it. And Gosling's character, Neil Armstrong, he looks around, he's like, are you kidding me? A Swiss Army knife? Like, what are we about to do here?
Yeah.
Right. And
you're shooting us to the moon.
Yes, and it just takes the time and lingers in that moment of, you know, it's almost like, I feel like when you're on a roller coaster and you're going up, up, up to the very, very top, and you have that moment right before it begins where you're like, I don't really know if I want to do this ride, you know, but these guys are going to the moon, and I think that that's a perfect way for Chazelle to sort of take this story that's obviously really familiar to all of us, and we know where it's going, but still make it really riveting and captivating.
Well, I think that's the key to a great filmmaker is when you have suspended your disbelief so much in a film that you completely forget what's going to happen and you're on the edge of your seat. Like, it's fascinating to me because I was watching the footage. For people who haven't seen it yet, it's playing before Mission Impossible in IMAX only. You basically step into the area with Gosling and you are in that cockpit wherever... for the next, 2-3 minutes, Sean, you think? And as it takes off, we're talking about some of the shakiest camera work you've ever seen in your life, because that's probably exactly what it felt like to be in there. And I have a feeling people are going to criticize the element of that because it is hard to see. But you also have to imagine that you are kind of Neil Armstrong in that moment. You are supposed to be in that moment with him, experiencing that terror, that anxiety, that unknown with him. But I'm telling you, man, once he steps out, Sean, I mean that IMAX footage of him walking on the moon and then the shot as he turns around with the visor and you can see everything.
Well,
it is
truly that's what's selling
remarkable.
Me truly. Yeah, I mean, I'm on board with this movie 100% anyway, but if the moon landing, the moon footage is where it blows up to IMAX, it's going to be, and he gives a little bit each time. The first time I saw it was at CinemaCon in Vegas and they showed the door opening and them going down the ladder. And it blew my mind. And in this one, they give you a little bit more. They
turns
show him
around.
Standing on the surface and the full scope of him turning around. And what it gives you is just this sense of, which I think we all had in Gravity, of your insides are turning. Because if I ever stop and think fully what these men, the memory that these men have, you know, of standing on the surface of the moon and looking out at the galaxy, it shouldn't happen. It shouldn't be possible. Yeah. And yet they did it.
It truly is insane. Yeah, it's truly insane to watch this footage. And I know Gabe, our producer, saw it too. For people who don't know, I mean, Chazelle, basically, he shot on the exact same formats that Nolan does. So it's 65mm IMAX, so it's going to blow up that big. So I recommend if people are seeing it, see it in the largest IMAX you can possibly see it, like a science museum. I think Sean and I probably both saw it in a digital IMAX when we saw Mission Impossible.
I did.
It still expands to the screen there, but it's not as large as Chazelle will intend it to be. If anybody out there saw Dunkirk or Interstellar or Dark Knight or Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol in 70mm IMAX, that's how big it's going to be. And that scene specifically is when it blew up on our screen because it was 35mm widescreen normal when we were doing the takeoff. And then, boom, step out of that freaking thing, step down, full-blown IMAX. And it is truly unreal. And I was sitting in a theater, sold-out theater on Mission Impossible, and people, here's the thing, people are kind of jaded when they go to the movies nowadays. They're talking to their friends or on their phones, whatever. When that moment happened, when he stepped out, there were gasps in my theater.
That's awesome.
It is dead silent. Dead silent. I mean, it kind of brings a whole new meaning to the whole concept of alien. Like, no, in space, no one can hear you scream. Like, it generally is this, like, horrifyingly beautiful moment. And just the colors of it, the way it looked so real. I genuinely thought we were sitting on the moon with Neil Armstrong. That's what it felt like. I mean, and I know it sounds exaggeratory, but that's what it felt like. And it's truly a remarkable thing that he chose to shoot large format like Nolan. So I think it's gonna be unbelievable.
I'm looking forward to sort of seeing how it, because I feel like standing on the moon is something that our brains just can't comprehend. Like there are a finite number of people that truly understand what that means. I got to interview Buzz Aldrin last year, and he was like trying to explain to me that feeling of when he, not necessarily even when he stepped on the moon the first time, but when he turned around and saw the Earth. And he's like, imagine seeing all of human civilization in your eye. Yeah. And like, we've seen pictures and stuff, but like, I just can't comprehend seeing that in the moment. And I look forward to a movie giving us an actual genuine feeling, a sensation that you could count the number of people that have experienced it on one or two hands.
I feel that way about Man on Wire. Like, that's one of the reasons why I love that documentary so much, is because that guy did something that no one will ever be able to do. Yeah. A, what he did is ridiculously impossible, but he did it. And then he can be like one of the very few people on this planet to be like, I did this and no one else will be able to do it.
I also thought Zemeckis
will ever be able to do it.
Zemeckis did a great job shooting the IMAX 3D movie aside, just the walk across itself. I want to mention one quick thing. Cause I know Sean, you and I saw Mission Impossible, and I was curious what your thoughts were on this. Cause someone had tweeted me this, and I remember thinking this as well when I first saw the movie, how similar Fallout is to The Dark Knight in regards to the way it uses sound and music and shots. Like, if you look at that whole sequence, if people out there who haven't seen the movie, remember the scene when he has the dream sequence about what's going to happen during that, when they essentially take Lane, when they essentially extract him?
Yeah.
So we go into that dream sequence, and there's like this beautiful music playing as the motorcycle's around the corner. And then we have that scene where Tom Cruise is about to shoot that guy, and then it kind of goes back to the reality. That is so Nolan.
I thought about that whenever we were watching it in Paris. My first thought was like, this is such a Nolan scene.
It's so Nolan. And honestly, if you guys remember Dark Knight very well, which I think we all do, remember the shot in Dark Knight when those guys are riding, the police guys are riding in that like truck, whatever, and they see the fire truck on fire, and they take the alternate route? That's exactly what happens in Mission Impossible.
That's true. Yeah, that's
the
true.
Truck falls, and then they take the route. That scene is so Dark Knight, and I would imagine that McQuarrie's aware of that, because it's very...
said that he went out of his way to try to make five Rogue Nation and Fallout feel like it was two different directors. I feel like that's a fun line for him to say in interviews, but the more I think about it, I do actually think that he made a conscious effort, and I do feel like...
Yeah.
They do feel like they're directed by two different people.
Absolutely.
I mean, if you literally study that scene, score, sound, everything, shot-wise, the way the police look, it is very Dark Knight. I mean,
like, he has...
eerily.
He did the spoiler podcast for Empire, and he says in that his editor, the whole time that they were working on Fallout, his editor kept turning to him and be like, this is a trilogy. Like, you're going to come back and finish this. And so watching this a second time, knowing that, like, there's more stuff, like, the reason that he leaves Solomon Lane alive, and there's just other plot threads that they need to pick up. Like, he has to come back for the seventh one. Christopher McQuarrie has to come back for the seventh one.
I still think it's the fourth best one.
But it's still amazing. It's still amazing.
Amazing movie, but I still cannot get past Henry Cavill as the villain, and I don't think the plot's that great. I really don't. I had the same problem that Jake has, by the way, with Protocol. I think it peaks in the beginning and the middle.
All right. Spielberg, Fincher, Chazelle, and Turtletaub. So let's transition to the Meg. That's my Rushmore. Turtletaub.
I quit this podcast.
Because he has a movie coming into theaters called The Meg, which stars Jason Statham as a shark hunting, I don't know. Stunt guy? What is this? Well, I guess professional. But I love Statham in this movie. So we're going to review The Meg. We're not going to get into any kind of spoilers. This is more of our sort of blunt
reaction.
What
are you going to spoil?
Does he live? Does the Meg survive?
And we have to make sure we mention that the embargo for this film lifts at 7 o'clock tonight. So we are going to give a reaction, but not our reviews. So like social reactions are out there now. So we'll react to it, but we'll get more in depth our review ratings wise next week.
Well, Gabe asked in the notes for this show, which I know you guys don't ever look at. I'm the only one who ever looks at the notes that Gabe produces.
I gotta be honest with you. I didn't know there were notes at this moment.
This is news to me. Wait, there are notes on a scale of Jaws to Sharknado. He's asking where would you place the Meg? If Jaws is the 10 and Sharknado is the 0,
here's my issue. Here's my biggest issue with the Meg is that
it's right in the middle.
Right in the middle. I stepped all over that. Pick a lane, Meg. Like, be goofy and silly or be a real film. But, like, it's just fine. It's whatever.
See, I like that.
It wasn't fun.
I like that it straddled that line.
I disagree with that.
I actually like that it straddled the line, to be honest. I really do. What I mean by that is Sharknado is absurdly ridiculous and stupid, and there's no emotional stakes whatsoever to those characters.
Correct.
Jaws is very serious, very, very in-your-face, horror, scary, thriller, whatever. Middle ground is what Turtletaub found here. I mean, it's a movie that does emotionally invest you in people. I'm not saying that these are, like, three-dimensional, like, major characters, but
Who are you emotionally invested in?
I cared for some of the characters. I really did.
What Kevin's saying, every single time any of the characters, and I'm not saying that they're well-crafted characters, but anytime any of them fell into the water, I legit was like, oh my gosh, get out of the water. Like,
right.
I need you to get out of the water.
If you're watching Sharknado and someone falls in the water, like, yeah, get him! You don't care. But I do think that there is a line that he found, and I'm not saying this movie is great, and I liked it, and I do recommend it, and I'll give my review later on, but I think it's an interesting thing that the movie starts off, it's actually genuinely serious, but never too serious, and then, really, you're paying your money to watch Jason Statham fight a 70-foot shark, and that's
and
what
he
you
does.
Get. And you a get
lot.
That. So it's
yes,
like, often. So to me, it's like, I don't know, to me it worked. I actually liked that it didn't go full Sharknado, and it didn't go full Jaws. It's a great spectrum that Sean brought up there. That's really the spectrum we're looking at. It's right in the middle.
I got to credit Gabe for the spectrum, and he's actually moving the sliding scale in the spectrum. So in the middle of this conversation, in the show notes that you guys don't look at, he said Deep Blue Sea would be the middle of that sliding scale spectrum. Then he thinks it's more like three quarters of the way closer to Jaws. I don't know. Deep Blue Sea wasn't that good.
I thought Deep Blue Sea was more closer to Sharknado. Like, Deep Blue Sea was a little goofier. This is definitely, to me, I saw the sold out crowd the other night. My wife had to see it for her reviews. I enjoyed the movie. I actually think it's fun. I think the people.
Oh, I would recommend it. I think people should go see it.
Yeah, I recommend it too.
It's, It's a high budget sci-fi channel shark movie.
Like, I disagree.
That undersells it. That undersells it.
That, I think movie. That appropriately sells it. There was nothing there. There's nothing that we haven't seen before. Even in the promos, it makes the shark look bigger than it actually looks in the movie.
Listen, I think in this movie, Jason Statham takes a page out of The Rock's playbook and does what Skyscraper should have done, which is it finds the right tone between campy and somewhat
and
serious.
Yeah. And serious. Like, I'll tell you right
I
now.
Feel, I think people are giving it a pass because it's just okay.
Well, they're giving you a pass because you're just okay.
By the way,
hey, that is my joke.
It is your joke, but it works every time. Every time.
You got to give a little credit to the visuals, by the way. There's
a
shot.
They're good. They're good.
There's a shot in this film that honestly, on the second viewing, it blew my mind. It's the scene where, and I won't give too much away.
Can I guess? Can I guess?
Go ahead.
Is it when the bigger thing comes after the smaller thing?
No. It's the shot. It's the shot. I don't even know what that means. Does that even make sense? Anyway, so it's, remember the scene, Sean, where I won't give anything away, but the shark is trying to swallow something, like very, very.
Stop, Jake. Stop.
No, stop. You know what I mean, Sean.
Stop.
There's
Jake.
A person
yes.
inside of a cage.
Oh yeah.
That
yeah.
looks. Amazing. That it scene does. Looks insane. Like, that's
and,
really well done.
And what Statham does as a character in that scene was
yeah.
really cool.
It was cool.
It was very
I
cool.
I liked it. I liked it. We'll get to the review later.
Someone in 20 years, me. When we do You Were Wrong Blend, this
right.
is going to be my pick.
We're not
We're
saying
look
the movie's
back
like...
I'm going to go, remember that time you guys gave glowing reviews to The Meg?
My friend Adam Fraser leaned over to me after The Meg screening, and he said, that's a better Jurassic Park sequel than Jurassic World was.
I agree.
Fallen Kingdom. Than Fallen Kingdom was.
I told Jake this the other day, and Jake got mad at me, but I genuinely mean it. The Meg is better than Christopher Robin. I'm sorry.
No! Oh my god!
It is a better
Oh my god, who are you?
It's a better
Are you
movie.
Dead
They're
inside?
Different. They're different.
But
They're hard to compare.
Sean, which one would you recommend someone to go see?
The Meg, in a heartbeat.
Exactly.
The Meg
Oh my
heartbeat.
God, I put this podcast!
Yeah, The Meg, in a heartbeat. I think more people have fun with The
fine.
Meg. Christopher yeah. Robin.
Oh, can you just replace me with Kalina? No, she has good movie taste. She wouldn't be able to, she wouldn't last long.
All right, we have to get to this week's...
Oh, I cannot believe you two just said that.
Blend game, which has been... Whew, this is a tough one. And Jake may even change his mind before we get to this one. And part
I
of the kinda, fun...
I actually kind of thought of that.
Part of the fun of this was that last week we changed the blend game from best to favorite. And I think that this is a perfect week for us to do favorites because we're doing hashtag ending blend. And I want to weigh in the fact that the people who are playing along at home on our Twitter feed, follow us at Real Blend. Please, if you've made it this far into the podcast, you guys had amazing suggestions, ones that made me almost change my mind about which ones I wanted to go to. And, you know, like, I think when you're choosing what you think your favorite ending is of all time, it's going to be deeply personal to you, and it's going to be why you think that this is the best ending. So I know that there's no way that we have the same one. Gabe, we all have to have three different ones, I would assume, right? Okay, three different ones. But I don't know how we guess. Like, it's impossible to guess.
Yeah,
so why don't we just go?
We can guess, can't we?
How? There's a bazillion movies to choose from.
I think I know Jake's.
Well, Kevin, you apparently, according to the show notes, we actually have show notes, and we fill in what the topics are going to be. But I want to let people know, peek behind the curtain, right before we start the show, Kevin says to me, goes, hey, can you tell me what the topics are for this, this week?
I did.
Okay, so what's really... worse, Kevin asking for the topics or me every week going, what time do we start?
What? And when Kevin said
we
tomorrow,
we start the same time every week.
For a minute, when he said tomorrow, I was like, "Oh shoot, are we tomorrow?" Kevin gets to go first, and Jake, do you want to guess? I mean, I feels like it's.
I'm only just because he put it in a tweet, and I have heard him talk about it extensively. I'm gonna say Gone Baby Gone.
Oh, I'm gonna say The Mist. I'll say The Mist.
It's funny that those are the two that I was torn between. I went with Gone Baby Gone.
That's great.
Your favorite movie ending of all time, Gone Baby Gone. That's interesting.
So let me tell you why. And in favorite, it's a very weird ending to call your favorite. The reason why I call it my favorite is because to this day, as I sit here, what year did that movie come out? 2008? What year was that film? 2007?
2007, I think.
Okay. So we're 11 years after that film came out. I still, to this day, am one, shocked and horrified by that ending, and two, I still don't know what I would have done in their situation. It is that conflicting to me. And I remember I just talked to Michelle Monaghan about it on the red carpet for Mission Impossible Fallout and told her that I still can't get over that ending. For people who haven't seen it or have seen it, I'd love to get your opinions on what you guys would have done in that situation. We all know the storyline. The little girl's kidnapped. Amy, who's the actress?
Amy Ryan, who is brilliant.
Yeah. Amazing. Should have won the Oscar that year.
Yes. Agreed.
She would have won the popular Oscar, probably.
So Amy Ryan is led to believe that her daughter's dead, essentially. That's kind of the mindset that she's in. Her daughter's gone missing. And we find out at the end that the daughter is safe and sound with Morgan Freeman and clearly living a very solidified, home, nice life that probably would be better for the daughter. And the idea that they end up giving the daughter back to Amy Ryan doesn't, like, Morgan Freeman, he goes to prison, or he gets obviously in very big trouble because he was part of the department. If I remember correctly, it's been a
also
long time.
Spoiler alert for Ending Blend, by the way.
Well, we're giving away so many different spoilers.
This is 11 years ago.
Yeah.
Anyway, so
fair game.
I remember sitting in the audience, like watching that moment when they decide to return the daughter to Amy Ryan, and I remember. Yeah. And do you remember the shot at the end when Casey is in the apartment and he kind of gives that face that he realizes he made?
Yeah, because doesn't
decision.
It imply that, like, the mother just goes back to her old ways of,
well,
like, leaving the kid?
Because she's 100%. A terrible mother.
Yeah.
A terrible mother.
Yeah. Yes. So,
the worst.
So the conflict there, the question being, for this
nature
little,
or nurture.
For it's this nature little girl's, or nurture. For this little girl's sake, for her life, I mean, like, the fact is, the way that mother lived, that girl could be dead in a year. I mean, like, she was a horrible mom.
Drug addict.
She could have
negligent
OD'd.
Mother.
The daughter could have gotten into some of her mom's stuff and died that way. Whatever that is. But then you have the other side of the coin where the daughter was kidnapped by Morgan Freeman's character, and he's giving this girl a great life. So the conflict of the
also,
idea.
Also, does Freeman end up going to jail?
I think he does.
I believe
he
does.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he does. But
Affleck is ruining multiple people's lives.
Well,
yes.
Well, that's
he did a wrong thing though. He kidnapped a kid.
Right. So therein lies the conflict.
Yeah.
Do you let a mother?
I think it's Affleck's best movie without question.
Do you let a mother continue living her life, thinking her daughter's dead, and then knowing that the daughter will have a greater life over here with the kidnappees? Or do you bring the kid back, knowing it'll have a really bad life, and then give the mother that option? I mean, what would you guys do in that situation?
I'd do the former. I would have left her. Also, because I give Amy Ryan's character 2 months before she's moved on, forgot she had a daughter.
Totally. I think over the course of the investigation, she does kind of forget. Yeah.
Trust me, Kevin, you're a good person. I get why you're torn about this. I just, based on that movie and based on those characters, and I'm not saying that in real life this is what I would do, but in that film with those characters in that scenario, I leave the kid with Morgan Freeman.
And you allow the mom to think her daughter's dead,
and let her be concerned about it for all of 18 minutes before she goes on another drug binge. Yes,
it's. I mean, listen, I'm kind of leaning more towards where you guys are too, but but imagine being a mother and knowing thinking your daughter's dead. I mean, it's a horrible, horrible thing. And that moment, that look on Affleck's face as he's sitting in the apartment.
I think he thinks he made a mistake by the time 100%.
100%. He knows he made a mistake.
All right.
Now I need to go back and rewatch this movie.
In a perfect world, that's a Dennis Lehane novel.
Shutter Island.
Written multiple books with those two detectives, with Casey Affleck and Michelle Monaghan's characters.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. There's like five or six at least. And I wish that they kept that as a franchise because I think that's the best of the books.
Does it reference the ending of Gone Baby Gone, or is that just a single
story? They're all connected. Yes, there's
a
sequel that's set a few years later called Moonlight Mile or something like that.
Yeah.
It's really good.
As I sit here explaining that ending, and
Ed Harris was great in that movie.
I'll say this. I have not watched Gone Baby Gone since I first saw it. And I'll never forget it because I watched it, and then Ben Affleck and Casey Affleck came to D.C. to AMC Georgetown and did a red carpet. And I remember Affleck walking up to me, and I made some reference to his character from Mallrats, and he started laughing or whatever. And we're at the Gone Baby Gone red carpet referencing Mallrats. But, you know, I saw the movie then, whatever year that was, 2007, 2008, whatever it was, and I have not watched it since. And to this day, I think about it at least once a month. And it's one of those things that just comes up in my mind, and I cannot get it off my mind. I don't know what I would do. And to me, that's the definitive way to end a film or end right. or book. So
Jake, you were torn. So what did you you end up on? What
I guess Jake's... I ended up sure. Yeah.
He went with Seven.
My favorite movie ending of all time I chose was Seven.
Wow.
I saw that movie when I was far too young to see that movie.
You were some but bleak it was, dudes.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the movie that taught me that if a movie is good enough, anything is possible with the ending. And that the good guy doesn't always win and the bad guy doesn't always lose. And sometimes things just don't work out. And the car ride leading to the desert where John Doe, played beautifully by Kevin Spacey, is essentially justifying himself for each person that he killed. And just the precision and the writing and the editing and the cinematography and the acting and the directing of that final sequence, just of the three of them just standing in the desert, is genuinely one of the most haunting sequences I've ever seen in my entire life. And these days, it's a little annoying because it gets kind of boiled down to people going, "What's in the box?" But
yeah.
One, that's one of Brad Pitt's finest acting moments. That is genuinely an unbelievable, like where he kind of starts like, he's holding the gum and he kind of starts like breaking a little bit.
It's the best cry I've ever seen in a film. Yeah.
He's like trying to hold it back. And that moment where you realize that this is exactly what Kevin Spacey wanted. And sort of like your ending, Kevin, then we're presented with a choice.
Yes.
Where does Brad Pitt sort of get like the vengeance that he wants. And Kevin Spacey is envy. And he like, do you kill the guy and essentially allow him to win? Mm. Or do you sort of withhold that anger in that moment and then keep his plan from coming to fruition? And it's an unbelievable moment where I still, like, I'm sure I would probably do exactly what Brad Pitt does.
Yeah.
And it's just unbelievable. And it's one of my favorite final quotes of a movie where Morgan Freeman says, Ernest Hemingway once wrote, "The world is a fine place and worth fighting for." And then there's a beat. And then he says, "I agree with the second part." Mm. And then he goes, dun, dun, cuts to black. Mm-hmm. And it's just the other ending I was debating on that I ultimately ended up not choosing was Shawshank. The reason I gave the edge to Seven is because ultimately Shawshank is Stephen King's ending. That's what he mm-hmm. wrote in the novella Rita Hayworth in The Shawshank Redemption. So in terms of like just truly great cinematic endings, I just don't think from a technical to a story point to an emotional standpoint, for me it doesn't get better than Seven.
I mean, that is an amazing ending, and it's like, and you're right, Jake. It's the exact same decision, and it's almost, and I don't know why I jumped to this in my mind just now, but I jumped to the moment in Infinity War when Pratt ends up messing
what
up
what did you
the,
do
messing the glove coming off of Thanos, and it's the same thing. It's like the concept of like you're so enraged that your emotions take over and logic goes out the window. I mean, Brad Pitt in that moment, logic was gone, and like the best thing about that ending, by the way, is the flash frame of Gwyneth's face is not her dead. It's her a happy face. Moment. Yeah, it's
because that's what is making him break down, because he's remembering. A lot of people say, "Oh, you get to see her head in the box." No, he's remembering how beautiful she was and how much he loved her. That's the tragedy. That
also
moment.
Because so much of that movie is about Pitt being so consumed by the investigation mm-hmm. that he's ignoring this life that he lives. And Morgan Freeman's character kept basically saying to him, "You have a beautiful wife, you know, and you're going to have a baby." Yeah.
There's even a scene right before Kevin Spacey comes out and screams, "Detectives!" I think a guy or a woman at a desk says, "Hey, like Detective Mills, like your wife called." He's like, "Yeah, I'll call her back later." Like that's the last thought he had about his wife.
In that moment, he's realizing the repercussions of this is that he's never going to have that life again, right? Yeah. Like that life that he has shelved for this investigation is never going to be his again. So bleak.
To me, those conflicts are so fascinating to me. And like, oh, it's weird. It's weird because we're saying favorite, like, as if we like these endings in the sense of like they make us happy. They don't. And what I think the concept of what, especially the ones that Jake and I chose, is that they're so conflicting that they leave you thinking emotionally. Yeah. I mean, I haven't seen Gone Baby Gone in 11 years. And that ending still makes the hair on my arm stand up.
And see, like, I've seen Seven probably 1,000 times. And me too. It still makes my hair.
And it works every time.
It's crazy.
Sean, I don't even know where to begin with yours, man.
I know Sean's.
Oh, good. Yes.
Forrest Gump.
Yes, it is. I was so happy when it ended. Yes, I was so happy when it ended. Yeah, it's funny. You both chose Morgan Freeman movies, whether you both realized it or not.
Yeah.
My alternate choice was a Morgan Freeman movie.
So Morgan Freeman is immersed in Real Blend this
week. Is he in yours?
No, he's not in mine, but Kevin Spacey is.
Oh, cool.
Usual Suspects.
I picked Usual Suspects.
Wow.
And if you go back and just think about the first time that you saw it, because it's so cliche, and the only thing that prevented me from potentially picking it is how cliched it is. But it's cliched for a reason.
But that's not the movie's fault.
No. Exactly.
Yeah, in the same way that, like, if a kid watches Die Hard today and they're like, oh, it's full of cliches. Like, no, it created the cliche. Yeah.
And this is what, like, in thinking about an ending of a movie, there were a lot of suggestions of people who were like, oh, that scene, you know, near the end. And it was like, no, that's not the end. Like, that movie, that screenplay, McQuarrie, of course.
Yeah.
Mm. Patron saint of Real Blend. Crafts the ultimate puzzle that is not finished until the very last piece is snapped into place.
Yeah.
And it is, and what it does is changes everything you just watched. It reverses it completely. Yeah. And how many movies have we watched, guys, that like just peter out with 15 to 20 minutes left to go, right? Like, they do something really, really cool, and then they don't know where to go with it.
The Meg.
Every beat of The Usual Suspects exists to drive home this, who is Kaiser Soze? And you get your answer, and the answer that you get, no one, I don't care who says that they knew it, no one saw it coming. No one. And when Kaiser Soze, when Kevin Spacey starts walking, and the montage of all of the things that he used,
the stuff on the coffee mug, and
in his story, like just off the, like a really big fat lady, you know, like orca fat, you know, like all this stuff that's on the board that he's pulling up, genius, and it's so mostly it's screenwriting, but then you backfill it and it's great stuff that the singer did, and it's the cast is amazing, but that ending is perfect. It's perfect. And so to me, that'll always be my favorite because I get a chill watching it play out every single time because Chaz is brilliant. And, you know, they even string along throughout the movie, the fax machine, you know, the description and it's, what is it going to look like? And that comes through and they keep
mentioning Chaz is also great in that moment. Spacey gets all the credit, but Chaz
incredible.
Sells that moment.
If
he isn't good, that scene doesn't work.
Totally. Well,
it really... To me,
the whole movie is great. The whole ensemble is amazing. But to me, that ending is so brilliant.
And what Sean just said about the idea of like picking that ending or not picking it, being worried about it being cliche. It's like Sixth Sense is obviously one of those endings where you think back on like the powerful element of an ending like that and Sixth Sense is the rewatch. Like the rewatch of those films ends up being even better than the first time because of the
fact that the rest of the movie is good. Like, an ending can be great, but if they're like, that's why I always argue about The Sixth Sense. Like, it's more than Bruce Willis was dead.
Right.
Usual Suspects is more than Kevin Spacey and Kaiser Soze. The rest of the movie is also good.
Did you see the tweet from M. Night Shyamalan the other day about what the original line was when he says, I see dead people?
He was kidding. Wasn't that a
joke?
No,
he wasn't kidding at all.
What was it? What did he say?
Something about, I see, I'll find it while you guys talk, but like, it was... The original line for the I See Dead People was not I See Dead People. It was something else. Hold on. I'll find it.
Oh, okay, so Sean, I have a question for you. So one of the, like I said, my other
Here
choice that I was thinking about was Shawshank. Okay, what is it?
The original line was, I observe deceased individuals, and then I rewrote it.
No, I think he was joking.
I think that's a joke.
Because he's been tweeting a lot about like writing, because he's been tweeting a lot about writing like a draft and editing it down to what you basically need. So I think his point is it started this really long sentence and he edited it down to the but I don't think that was the actual real line.
I hope not. Oh,
I don't think it was.
That's a hacky line.
Because it's a joke that goes along with what he's been talking about a lot on Twitter. Okay, I have a question. If I had chosen Shawshank, which I did not, I chose Seven. If I had chosen Shawshank, would you have made the argument that the prison break is not the ending?
Oh, I think the ending is him walking on the beach.
Right.
See, and that's weird, because when I think of, when someone says, like, how does Shawshank end, I go, oh, he breaks out of prison.
Yeah, no,
but there's there's another half hour left in the movie.
Yeah, it's not the prison break. That, to me, is not the ending.
I just had a flashback when you mentioned beach to the Road to Perdition ending. When you just hear the water and, like, the waves crashing.
And you see, in Conrad L. Hall's cinematography, you see his son in the reflection of the glass, and he waves at his son, and in the reflection, it's all the same shot. You see his son wave back, and then two gunshots, and then in the reflection, you see his son panic and then run off.
I have shivers. Oh. And then we're Jude Law's face, God. Yeah. Like,
he's got the glass all over him.
It's one of the best endings ever.
I have no clue how neither of you guys picked a Nolan movie, because, truthfully, there are a lot of Nolan movies whose ending should be Prestige. In contention.
Yeah.
Prestige? You wouldn't even say Inception?
Here's the thing. Those are all great endings.
His best ending is
Batman Prestige. Begins. Batman Begins! Prestige. The Joker flip card is the best!
I still think Interstellar, but one of those things... I love Interstellar, and when he walks in and meets his daughter as an older woman, that is so devastating. But anyways, but the reason I didn't pick Nolan is, as much as I love his endings, it's not something, besides the ending of Inception with the turning of the totem, none of them have actually made me conflicted. I think it's the conflicted part of me that finds the Gone Baby Gone one so hard to chew on, because any route you go there, something's wrong. There's no right answer. Legally speaking, there's a right answer, but there's no right answer. It's a horror. And then same with Jake's thing with Brad Pitt's gun to Basie's head. It's like one of those things. Like, do you take out the guy who killed your wife and let him win?
Right.
Or do you want that satisfaction of blowing his brains out? And it's like, it's, I don't know, man. These are horrible, horrible decisions that I hope no one ever has to make in their own lives.
The audience playing along. Susan Smith said Shawshank Redemption. But now I want to know what Susan Smith thinks is the ending of Shawshank Redemption.
Right. I think the average person would say it's the prison break. But I think the more I've thought about it, and I was distraught about this with Gabe, our producer Gabe. I think I'm with you. I don't think the prison breakout actually counts, because there's so much movie left.
Yeah.
So by definition of the ending,
Chris Falk says Good Will Hunting, great ending. Where he finally goes and knocks on Will's door and he doesn't answer.
Oh, yeah.
Tremendous ending. That's a really good one.
Robin Williams ad-libbed that last line.
Oh, does he?
Something about, like what did he say? Like, stole my joke or something like that? And he's, like, reading. And he's like,
I thought he said it's hunting season. Doesn't he say it's hunting season?
Now that.
Jesus Christ. Do you want this podcast to go on for another hour?
I know. Grayson Tumult says The Mist. And The Mist is another one.
The Mist is insane.
And that's different from what King wrote, right? Because Darabont changed that.
Like, King wrote, if you read the short story, it's a fairly hopeful ending, which is unusual for Stephen King. He normally writes very heavy endings. The ending in the book is them, like, stopping, I think, at, like, a gas station or something, and they find, like, this old radio, and they're, like, flipping through the channels, like, trying to find help because they've left the grocery store and they're going out, and he catches a glimmer of someone talking on the radio before it disappears, and in his head he thinks, like, okay, people are out there, like, we can do this, and that's how the book ends.
That scene, though, when he kills everyone in that car, including his son, and then 5 minutes later the military rolls up. Hey, could we help you? I mean, talk about one of the most shocking things I've ever seen in my entire life. I mean, I'll never forget that. I'm seeing that and just being floored. I was like, "What the heck?"
And Thomas Jane's like his scream.
Oh, God. Could you imagine?
That's like, I would imagine that's and Sean, you can correct me if I'm wrong or right. That's going to be a movie that's going to be even harder to watch once I have kids.
Completely.
The thought of killing your kid and then realizing 30 seconds later you didn't have to,
and you're killing your kid It's really to keep him from being killed by these monsters. Yeah. I mean, it's like this insane. Yeah. I think
King has come out saying that he likes the movie ending better than the one he wrote.
He's a sick bastard. That's why.
Yeah.
Ted Meyer says the original Italian Job, and I'm not quite sure how that movie ends.
Yeah, neither do I.
Sort of look at that ending, and then Maureen Gribble says
with Michael Caine.
It's a Wonderful Life. Yeah, the Michael Caine one, not the. that was pretty good, Jake. Next week. So we did ending blend, so we have to do hashtag opening blend.
Oh, yeah. I already have my answer.
Do you really?
Oh, God, wait, do I? Oh, no.
So is it opening blend or beginning blend?
They're both the same, but I would do opening blend.
I feel like when I think of a movie, I think of opening. Like the opening.
Yeah, the opening blend. Hashtag opening blend. So play along. Follow us at Real Blend. Let us know your choice for opening blend.
I think Jake and I are going to have the same one.
I don't think so.
I know Jake's.
I don't think you do.
Jake, without saying it, does your movie title have two words in it?
No.
Oh, okay.
Oh, good. Okay, we will be back next week.
Wait,
yes.
I guess the Meg. I guess, yeah. I guess. Yeah.
You can follow us at Real Blend, at Jake's Takes, at Kevin McCarthy TV, and
is
at
Dunkirk
Sean
two words?
_ Dunkirk.
The entire Dunkirk is the opening of Dunkirk. The entire movie is the opening.
Thank you very much for tuning in and watching our show this week, and we will be back at it next week. Talk to you guys then.
Dunkirk
sucks.
No, it doesn't.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search. Match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar-S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.